on The Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, as our ongoing salute to veterans, today we have a most unusual book. It's based on true events. And if you've listened to On the Bookshelf through the years, you know that we've talked to people before about the situation that the Allied POWs found themselves in during World War II. Probably for Americans and for Filipinos, the most egregious of the situations began with what is called the Bataan Death March. And here to talk to us today is Tosca Lee, who, along with Marcus Brother, are the authors of The Long March Home, a World War II novel of the Pacific. It's from Revel, which is a division of Baker Publishing House. Our guest today is the co-author, Tosca Lee, who is award-winning New York Times bestselling author of 12 novels, including The Line Between, The Progeny, The Legend of Sheba, and Iscariot. What gives it sort of a local flair for us is that the three heroes of the story come from Mobile, Alabama, and these are based on true events. So I'm very excited to welcome our guest today, Tosca Lee. Tosca, thank you so much for joining us on The Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how did you guys get together to work on this novel?
You know, I knew Marcus because even though Marcus is best known for his World War II biographies and his nonfiction, and he's got a lot of that, he wrote a novel about 10 years ago, and he reached out to me to endorse it, and that means to write a potential blurb for the cover. And so that novel was called Feast for Thieves. And so what many people don't know is that Marcus has done some fiction before. And so he reached out and he said, hey, will you take a look at this? And I ended up endorsing that book. A few years later, around 2017, he reached out to me and said, you know, I've been working on this kind of back burner, unfunded, you know, we call it on spec, meaning it's not been paid for by a publisher. It's something we're doing and hope to sell down the road. He's been working on this back burner project about the Bataan Death March. He said, I feel like it's a good manuscript. I feel like it's not all the way there, though. Would you like to join me? And I said, I have not heard of this chapter of history. I've done a lot of historical novels, but my historical novels, when I'm, you know, writing and researching, is 2,000, 3,000 plus years ago. So this is very recent as far as what I'm used to.
Right.
And so he explained it to me, and a lot about what you just talked about. As far as the American involvement in the Pacific theater, specifically in this case in the Philippines, and about the Allied surrender in April of 1942, and then what became known as the Bataan Death March, which was only the beginning of a terrible almost 4 years for those who survived as POWs. And so when he was telling me about this, I had not known about it before, but I knew immediately that, you know, if I hadn't heard of this, there's other people who haven't heard of it also, and it's an important chapter in history. And I said, so let's do it. And so I started working with him. He essentially handed over his manuscript and everything and said, have at it, do what you will. And so I went in and started doing my own research because I, you know, needed to get up to speed on all of this. And, you know, that's what we do as novelists. And I added 5 years to the process. So this, by the time we sold it, it was a 12-year novel, 7 for Marcus and 5 for me.
Wow.
And at the end, we were polishing, editing, you know, passing it back and forth, honoring one another's non-negotiables, even as we compromised on other things. And it comes out in just a few days.
Let's talk about our main characters. We really have three men, and when they start out, three
boys.
Teenagers. Yeah, they're boys.
Yeah, that's right.
A girl who's the older sister of one of the three, who is the lifelong friend and romantic interest, at least for a time, of one of the three, and kind of a casual romantic interest for the third guy. So there's one girl and three guys that are the main people, but it's what happens to them that makes and how they interact, not just prior to the war, but also, you know, as the war is going on, that makes for such a compelling story. So you want to tell us about Jimmy and Billy and Hank and Claire?
Yes, absolutely. So Jimmy's our main character, and he is the son of a pastor. And his closest friend since birth, basically, is Claire, who is the oldest sister, older sister of Billy, who's his other best friend. Billy's a year younger. And then Hank comes along when Jimmy and Claire are in third grade, and Hank's kind of the bad boy, you know, the one that everybody wants to be around. Billy's kind of the happy-go-lucky, fun younger brother figure. And then, as you mentioned, Claire is the love interest. And they really are, you know, they are boys. And this book has a dual timeline, which I felt was really important in going into the story, because the story itself, I mean, the story of being the war, and the war was so logistically fraught, you know, without enough supplies and food and medicine. The war is so gritty, and what happens in the aftermath is so gritty that for the sake of our readers as a novelist, it seemed important to have this dual timeline where every now and then we could step back into the late 20s and into the 1930s and see how these boys bonded and became true brothers as they grew up, and see their coming of age. And so we have this dual timeline that shows the things that bonded them, that shows them going crabbing and frogging and fishing in Mobile and doing all the things that boys do up until the time that Jimmy is 18 and they enlist. And Billy is actually, he's 17, but he lies about his age, which is something that happened.
Yeah, because he doesn't want to miss out on this adventure. And these right. two guys are like brothers to him, even mm-hmm. though he has younger sisters and an older sister. They're kind of mm-hmm. filling the role for brothers. And Hank, there's a loss in his family early on. There's a loss in Claire and Billy's family. I mean, it was the time. People died of all sorts of things. There are losses, and they help each other through them all.
Mm-hmm.
Once they get in the military, they go to the Philippines, and it's a beautiful place to be for a time.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, the Pearl of the Orient.
They're part of the 31st Infantry. Yeah, Manila was called the Pearl of the Orient, and this was considered a plum assignment, preferable to many of these men to even Hawaii, because you could buy so much with your dollars. There was so much to do and see, and it was a paradise for a time.
So it all goes bad mm-hmm. on December the 8th, 1941, a long-fought-out situation, and for these guys, they express the attitude that a lot of guys did that were left in the Philippines when MacArthur is ordered to leave and takes his staff with him and as many nurses as they can and all, but they leave an awful lot of American soldiers in the Philippines, and particularly the Philippines is an archipelago, so there are 20,000 islands or something. This is one right. of the main islands, and these guys...
This is Luzon.
Yeah. Yes, they're holding out with the hope that somebody's coming back, that somebody's sending ships, that somebody's going to rescue them,
mm-hmm.
and that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it not only does it not happen, but they're running out of food. These guys have all had dysentery and malaria and all these different diseases. They, you know, early on, Wainwright had this very special horse, and he was one of the first people to give up his horse for his men to eat. I mean, then these guys were later on eating lizards, cats, whatever they could get a hold of, because they did not have enough food. And there they were backing up down the Bataan Peninsula and defending the peninsula and holding out for the reinforcements that never came.
Yeah. And because of that, because of those expectations that never were fulfilled, eventually mm-hmm. they decide, or the officers decide, to surrender, thinking mm-hmm. that they will be treated well, because that's what armies do. That's actually mm-hmm. the Germans treated POWs fairly well, as particularly compared to how the Japanese did. But what they find mm-hmm. is that the code of Bushido considers these not to be real men because they've surrendered, and therefore they're not right. going to be treated like soldiers or warriors. They're treated like worms, and they're mm-hmm. to be used for whatever they want. And when they die, no one will care. Their country is ashamed of them and so forth. This is the beginning of years worth of misery and suffering.
Absolutely. Yeah. So these men were the American and Filipino, the Allied forces that surrendered. And there were some 70,000 on April 9th in 1942. And because of the culture of Japan, of Imperial Japan, It was considered traitorous to your country, to them. The mere idea of surrendering was just absolutely disgraceful.
And so these guys, they're going to be treated worse than they ever could have imagined. And there is there's a very vicious streak in the Japanese army at this point, that officers beat lower officers, who beat sergeants, who beat corporals, who beat privates, who beat the POWs. But there's plenty of brutality to go around. Do we want to talk some specifics? I know that there were about, 10,000 Americans, 62,000 Filipinos marching 60 miles along the Bataan Peninsula en route to prison camps. A lot of them died on the way.
Thousands of them died on the way. And in fact, not only did they just drop from sheer exhaustion and dehydration and hunger and disease, and they just couldn't go anymore. But if you stopped to try to drink some water, or if you rushed off into a field to try to grab a sweet potato, or if you tried to fill your canteen with brackish water that you were marching through, which wasn't even appropriate to drink, they would shoot you or bayonet you or run you over. And so even if you tried to sustain yourself in some way, you would be punished for that. And so 60-some miles without food, water. And every now and then, I think several days in, they were given a very small ball of rice or something like that, not enough to get you by. But what happened is the Japanese at that time were just not prepared for this massive number of POWs to surrender.
Right. They didn't really know what to do with them. They didn't. And their resources were limited also. So now they don't know how to handle it. They don't know
how to feed them. Yep.
And they don't really, and honestly, they don't really seem to care very much if they do or not.
Yeah. Right. That's true.
So then some of them survived the prison camps with terrible deprivation and daily beatings, that sort of thing, working them to death in rags, insufficient food to maintain their life. Medicines that are being sent by the Red Cross are withheld and kept at home and so forth. They are there for 41 months, and then they're put on the hell ships and sent off to work in slave labor on the Japanese main islands. And some of them don't make it that far because they're sunk by American submarines.
Absolutely, because these were Japanese ships, and so sunk by submarines, but also I believe they were also bombed by planes as well. And the men, and even if they did make it, there were many men who went absolutely just insane in these holds of these ships because they were there for long periods of time, many days, in the dark, without sufficient food or water again, without sanitary conditions. These ships, as you mentioned, they're sunk. Every now and then there's a few survivors, but they were basically being bombed by our own people.
Right.
So,
and once they get to the slave labor camps, they're not treated any better. If anything, they're wearing out. These three friends, there's some extraordinary adventures.
There does come a point where two of them are given an offer to carry out a task, and the third one is held back. And if they don't return, if they don't carry out the task, if they don't succeed, their third best friend will die. And it's a really interesting moral quandary. And this whole story, from a story point of view, just stepping outside even of the history, is this kind of fog of war that includes not just the war itself, but also the moral questions and the gray areas of what is right and what is wrong when everything becomes very murky.
Yeah. Stealing from each other, not because they want to, but because they know they'll die if they don't, and yet they realize the consequences of that are their comrades will die in their place. And these sort of moral issues become very murky in a situation like this, yet the importance of friendship cannot be understated in this. These guys hold on as long as they can. Is it fair to If I'm going to throw something away here, you say so, and we'll stop, and I'll just make a point and edit it. But they don't all come home. Is that safe to say? Or would you rather not say that?
It's safe to say they're probably not all going to come home. Okay. But I should say too that, the survivors that told their accounts, and many of them would not share their accounts until much later in life, because when they came home, they just simply did not talk about these things.
Right.
They didn't call it PTSD. It was survivor's remorse is what they called it at the time. But many men could not or would not talk. And then later in life, they would sometimes share these accounts in such vivid detail, remarkable detail, especially at the later age that they were. But they made a point many times of saying that the men who survived were the ones who had friends to look out for them. And so friendship played such an important role in the survival of those who made it home.
Let me also say that another issue for these guys and for many Americans, as well as Brits, Australians, New Zealanders that were POW, and the Dutch, who were all POWs among the Japanese during the Pacific Theater during World War II, that they were subjected to the kind of suffering that's really unimaginable, and that that any of them survived is miraculous.
Yeah,
and
it is. When you read the accounts, it's unthinkable to believe that anyone could have survived. You know, maybe one thing, or maybe two things, or maybe a few months of this, but year after year, and thing after thing after thing. I mean, just event after event, torture. You know, continued malnutrition, continued being worked to death. It is a miracle.
I think one of the things that those survivors had to come to grips with the concept of forgiveness. We have one of our characters, Jimmy, is a preacher's son, and for a while he struggles with his faith in the midst of living in hell on earth. He wonders, where's God? And not an unreasonable question, and certainly not the only one in World War II that ever asked that question. And then when it's all over, the Japanese kind of send out this little token, hey, sorry we were so tough on you guys. No, you know, hope you don't hold a grudge. And I can only imagine, and there were guys that went back and confronted their tormentors 20 years later. There was a movie released just a couple of years ago with Colin Firth, where he's one of these guys who can never get past what he suffered. It's quite extraordinary, and I was reminded of that again when I read your book, that if you had the chance to go back and treat these people the way you were treated and the way that they treated your friends you lost in the midst of all this chaos and blood and ick, would you? You know, there was I remember reading of a guy who, after World War II, became converted to Christianity and went back to Japan and found the Japanese pilot who led the attack on Pearl Harbor and led him to Christ.
Wow.
And I think about people like that and pray that I would be that guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I have kind of a bad feeling. Mm-hmm. That'd be a very, very, that is absolutely evidence of a miraculous changed life. Because
absolutely.
These are guys pushed way beyond anything that anybody thought was possible to survive. And by people who would have gleefully killed them at the time. And then once they realized they lost the war, they were stunned because there was no word for surrender in Japanese prior to World War II. They had to create a word in their language because they'd never lost a war before. Writing the story, what was the most difficult part of it? Was it recreating the tortures and the torments and the misery of these guys, or was it trying to figure out what it would be like for them, or what was it going to be like for their families that were at home, wondering if their sons were alive somewhere? Would they return, or would they just vanish? What was the toughest thing?
You know, one of the toughest things was just the research into the actual survivor account, because it's so much, and it's so heavy, and it's so awful. And so it's the kind of thing where, you know, when you research for a novel, you're researching day in and day out, full-time, like it's a job. It is our job. We're both full-time writers, Marcus and I. And so you're immersed in this for hours and days and months and years. And this was a project of years. And that doesn't mean we were researching it for 12 years straight, but, right. You know, you're in it. And so it's very heavy. It lays very heavy on the heart to research all of this. And then to decide how much your reader can take, because readers who read fiction are reading for similar but different reasons than those who read nonfiction. And so readers who read fiction are reading to be immersed in the experience, which makes it that much more visceral than if you're simply reading an account of something that happened. Mm-hmm. And so deciding to pick and choose what part of that journey and what which of the terrible things you're going to include, and there were plenty to pick from, that was tough because your reader can only take so much, and that was a big part of why it was important to have that dual timeline, that every now and then we skip back into the past, into, yes, it's Depression era Alabama, but at the same time, it is a simpler time, and it's a more innocent time. And so we take those breaks every now and then, and it gives us a reprieve, but it also raises the stakes, and it shows us why it's so much more important even that these boys all survive and come home together, because now we feel for them and we understand them and we've grown up with them.
Now, Jimmy's dad, the pastor, is pretty hardcore. He
yes.
He is very tough on Jimmy. He is very tough on Jimmy's companions and friends. He doesn't want him to associate with Hank, who he ends up mm-hmm. going off to war with. His expectations, his son's going to follow in his footsteps. He's going to go off to, it's all planned out. He's going to go off to seminary,
yes.
and he's going to do this. He's
yes.
going to marry Claire. Everybody's going to live happily. He's going to come back here. Everybody lives happily ever after. And Claire's mm-hmm. mom and Jimmy's mom are best friends. They both kind of instinctively know that Jimmy is not really, as he gets older, he's starting to realize, I'm not sure that's what I want. And not that he isn't crazy about Claire, but does he have to have the whole package? And mm-hmm. and this is very interesting, because this is not an unusual thing for it to happen to a young man, to have a father who kind of plots out his son's life for him, because he wants him to have the good stuff that he's had, but he wants to avoid the bad stuff that he had to go through. So he comes up with these ways of, this is what you can do, and if you do it this way, you know, you won't have your heart broken, or you won't run out of money like I did, and have to eat beans in school and all that stuff.
Right.
Which makes Jimmy a great lead character, because he's got a lot of stuff going on internally that leads him into making this life-changing decision to join the military.
Mm-hmm.
Hank and Billy are pretty well drawn too. I mean, Hank's a guy that's living kind of in the shadow of his big brother, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are all characters that have something that I think many of us can identify with, whether it's the expectations of parents, whether it's living in the shadow of somebody else, whether it's being the younger sibling who's just, you know, kind of free to do whatever because all this attention, family attention, is on other people in the family, whatever it is. And, you know, Jimmy's dad he's kind of a picture of living under the law. So he's very legalistic. And you know, this is a story, ultimately. It's a redemptive story. It's a story of grace. And it's a story of, you know, how is it that you earn the right to survive over somebody else? Or how is it that you've been given something that somebody else has not? You know, how did you ever deserve that? Or what could you do to deserve that? And the answer at the end of the day is nothing. And so with Jimmy's dad, it was an important part of the story to show the kind of evolution, not just of the dynamic between Jimmy and his dad, but with his dad as well. So we've got character arcs happening all over the story that made it very interesting for us, and that we hope will make the experience more rich for the reader.
We could talk about this book really for another 30 minutes easily, just talking about the characters that our three heroes meet that are based on truth, or actually you know, it's the real character, essentially, like Felipe Kulala. We could talk about all these, because there's wonderful characters in this, and there are terrible people as well, and then there are everybody else. And those who are trying to get by as best they can in a very, very murky world.
You know, I just wanted to say that I had some wonderful sources in Mobile, Alabama, who were very helpful to me as far as the research into Jimmy and Hank and Billy's growing up. Her name's Sherry, Sherry Saint, and she also was the one who told me about Jubilees and this whole phenomenon and, you know, things like that that really enriched the story. And so I'm just really grateful. I'm grateful, of course, to the veterans and those who went before and those who paid these terrible prices. And I'm grateful for those who help us continue to draw attention to the heroes of these lesser-known chapters of history as well. People like Sherry, who has helped contribute to the story, and our wonderful editors, and, of course, my co-author, as we try our best to honor and shine a light on these heroes.
Well, it is truly a remarkable story, astounding chapter of history, and really well told. The book is The Long March Home, a World War II novel of the Pacific, by Tosca Lee, our guest today, and Marcus Brotherton, New York Times bestselling authors, both of them. It's from Revel, a division of Baker Publishing Group, and you can find out more about them on a wide host of websites, ToscaLee.com. Check them on Facebook, on Twitter, Instagram, Goodreads, BookBub, and Amazon. You'll find both of the authors of this book all over these places, and it should be pretty easy to find them. And Tosca, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today about this extraordinary book.
Oh, Doc, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your interest, and thank you for reading it.
It was a tough read because for a Christian novel, it's pretty gritty in places. This is not your sweet little normal romance novel with a little war thrown in. But that's what made it so really so compelling, and why I fought the urge every night after I'd read a couple of chapters to go, I wonder what the last chapter says, you know, because that's. That you always want to do that, but in real life you can't. Mm-hmm. So the best way to read a book is not to fudge and see who makes it or doesn't
no
or whatever.
Cheating.
You know, it's the reading of it and the living it through them with the characters that helps them to come to life as well. So
absolutely.
Thank you so much, Tosca.
Thank you so much.
And may God continue to bless your work on His behalf.
Thank you so much.
Our thanks again to Tosca Lee, the co-author with Marcus Brotherton of The Long March Home, a World War II novel of the Pacific from Revel Books, a division of Baker Publishing Group. And the story is that of three young men from Mobile, Alabama, who survived the Bataan Death March, but then their real adventure begins. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this way of our stretching out our observance of Memorial Day this year, and we hope that you'll be with us again next week. I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Be sure to check out our website, WTBFradio.com, and my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com for more. Till then, thanks for listening, and God bless.